Welcome to, we're going to open up the House Committee on Veteran Affairs on February 22nd. Please turn off your cell phones. We enjoy hearing all the little tunes, but sometimes they're distracting. And then I'm also going to open up a subcommittee hearing, public hearing on Senate Bill 1561. We have Senator Boquist, Paul Evans, and Brigadier General Caldwell. So let's have Senator Boquist lead us off.
You notice I'm going to sit on the right, co-chairs.
But my left.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Boone, and distinguished other members of the committee, I'm Senator Brian Boquist. I'm here in my capacity, not as my District 12, which is five rural counties, and we were just talking about earlier, chunking creeks, water, and cutting timber, which we'd like to do more of, by the way, committee members. But I'm here in my capacity as the Chairman of Veterans and Military Affairs on the fall side. You have before you SB 1561. First, I want to clarify that in our committee, what we did is that we created several broad relating clauses, one relating to the military department, one relating to veterans, and then we put a whole series of technical fixes, or had the opportunity to put a whole series of technical fixes into them. You have another bill that's coming through that looks like Mae West's laundry, and you'll see there's four or five items in it, in two. This particular bill, 1561, the first thing, I'm telling you what it's not, is that in the A1 amendment, which I believe all the committee members have seen, is not required and we don't need it. And from our committee perspective, we don't want to proceed with that. It's a ways and means issue, and it appears that they've gotten that fixed. The main body of 1561 comes from, if you recall, back in the 2005 session, and I know all of us that are here, at the podium here and on the dais is there, we're here. We started the discussion of what happens in a catastrophic event and what is the continuation party procedure short of declaring martial law, because, as you know, the governor doesn't have the power to shift money around in the event of a catastrophic earthquake or a major event. You'll recall that in the spring of last year, we had some more debate on this issue, and we put on the ballot this November will be a referral in which, you know, sets up a procedure. So if there is a 9-0 earthquake, or Mount St. Helens goes off, or Mount Hood goes off, or something along that line, there is a procedure in place for the governor to provide emergency services while we, the legislature, come back into session. Unfortunately, maybe Representative Boone might not be here as an example because of the situations on the coast. But part of that mechanism is also a small entity called the Homeland Security Council, which is in 1561. And in part of the discussions, the consideration came back again, well, who's going to be there on a day-to-day basis for the first 30 days, and who's there on a day-to-day basis on these sorts of issues? As part of that referral, we did some small changes to improve the efficiency of the Homeland Security Council, which works on a day-to-day basis. As you know, you have two members from your chamber on that council and two members from our chamber on that council. The Homeland Security Council is a work in progress. It still has a mechanism in it, and to bring in broad community support from sheriff's county, so on and so forth, but then it has to be slightly more functional on a day-to-day basis to interface with the referral. You'll notice in 1561 that's there that it only goes into place if the referral passes. And again, I think the three members of the Distinguished Committee on Veterans will recall that rather strangely, the Secretary of the Senate summoned me to the floor last year, and I had a discussion with one of the caucuses on the floor in regard to this particular bill, this particular function of the Homeland Security Council, and the function of what happens in a catastrophic earthquake. So really, it's a small house cleaning bill. We expect to come back in discussions with the governor and the council itself. I sit on the council. On your side, Representative Frederick is one of the individuals that sits on the council. And again, it's a work in progress. It's getting more functional. We want to ensure that we still have the input from county sheriffs, EMS, all those sorts of things that we've traditionally had, but then we also have to make it functional. I don't know how the House side works, but to give you an example on our side and the Senate side, one of the two senators that's on there is on the access list, in which we see a lot of events and have a lot of input into events that transpire in the state that most people don't see. On our side, what transpires is that one of the two senators, myself or the other senator, goes through, looks at the types of events, and then contacts the members in that district that it impacts and advises them what's going on so that they need to get involved with the local authorities or so they're aware of what's going on. And so there actually is a day-to-day function that happens for the members, unlike many of the committees we all get appointed to where we meet once a year and stamp it and said we were there. I go through a weekly report and share it with the members, that are the selected members. And then, of course, it is the responsibility of the four members on the Homeland Security Council to keep the two presiding officers, excuse me, three presiding officers, I stand corrected, the three presiding officers aware of what's going on. So that's really the genesis of 1561. It was a committee bill. It does have the Homeland Security piece in there, which is a fix that only takes effect on the passage of the ballot measure. With that, I'd be delighted to answer questions or get out of your hair.
Any questions? I have one. Who's on the committee? Who's all on this committee?
The committee is set up now under the original statute from 05 when we passed it, and somebody might have to nod as we go back there. The Adjutant General's on there. The Governor's on there. The Superintendent of State Police is on there. There are some other staff support people that are on there. And then on our side, there are two senators and two representatives.
Who's the representatives and the senators?
On our side, it's Senator Verger and myself, one Democrat, one Republican. And on your side, it's Representative Frederick and Representative Freeman.
Okay. Thank you.
So with that, I'll get out of your hair.
Thanks, Senator.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Always good seeing you. Paul Evans.
That's the right one.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, member of the House Committee. my name is Paul Evans. I reside at 744 Main Street East, Monmouth, Oregon, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you about Senate Bill 1561. There are some supporting documents, I believe, being passed out at this time. Most of these materials were emailed to you yesterday, so if you already have that, then that's what's being passed around. To begin with, I am a former member of the Oregon Homeland Security Council. I currently am not affiliated with any state agency. In fact, I'm currently unemployed, so I have no dog in this fight whatsoever except a very passionate relationship to what we could have done and what we can do. So I'm going to take the next few minutes and try to explain a couple of points related to what I hope will happen with 1561 and potentially 1561's successor bill in the next legislative session. To be blunt, Senate Bill 1561 was written and likely passed the state Senate last week because members of the Oregon Legislature are frustrated with the Oregon Homeland Security Council as it currently exists. I want to publicly praise Senator Boquist for bringing the issues forward. I think the contingency piece is important, but I am worried when an agency that is potentially about the homeland security of the state is only state agency personnel. And I understand that through statute you can change it, and I'll talk about how that can work, but I think it sends the wrong message at this time. Many of the frustrations are warranted. I will acknowledge that. The Oregon Homeland Security Council, first established in 2005, was modified through executive action in 2008, and is supposed to provide Oregon leadership with critical policy work, advice and counsel on matters including crisis prevention, disaster response and recovery, and policies necessary for securing our air, land, and water. Again, for the record, I accept a large part of the blame for the failure of the OHSC. We didn't get enough done when we were at that point. During the Kulongoski administration, I was responsible for making it work, and though we made progress, much of that progress was lost. I want to explain how that happened and how we can make sure that doesn't happen again in the future. The former OEM director, Ken Murphy, and his senior staff maintained a different philosophy about emergency management. Now, let me be very clear. Ken is not bad, wasn't ill-meaning. He's a good and decent man who I actually sit down and have coffee with every now and then and like. But in many ways, Ken and his managers believed they were FEMA representatives to Oregon. This was a philosophy that supported a reactive rather than proactive approach. It's the wait to be told it's okay approach rather than the help people first and find a way to fix it afterwards approach that colored Governor Kulongoski's approach. Again, this is not personal, but it reflects an important divide. The philosophy of wait and be told it's okay became obsolete when Katrina became such the failure that it was. Katrina was a seminal event in Homeland Security policy in the United States. Government does not have the resources, as you know, to be everything to everyone every time. In truth, government never did have that capacity. But after Katrina, we knew a new strategy was needed for sustained success. Translated, we needed to become better at managing our resources and building relationships and leading our communities before, during, and after crisis, because lives and property would depend upon it. We must reach out beyond past paradigms that confined emergency management, homeland securities, to just the professionals. We can't do that anymore. In 2007, we learned a lot from Top Off 4. Then we learned even more from the disasters of 2007 and 2008. As a result, Governor Kulongoski implemented Executive Order 0820 in order to facilitate a more effective crisis disaster response recovery capability. Again, I make no argument. If you want efficient, go with what's there. But efficient isn't always better. Government isn't about efficient. Government is about effective. We worked hard on transforming the entire structure. And for a time, it was functioning. Accordingly, we invented a larger Oregon Homeland Security Council, one that could have worked better, admittedly. In fact, I believe it would have worked had we sufficient resources, but more importantly, had we sufficient investment in making the program work. We didn't, and we weren't able to transform the environment to make it work fast enough. While we were able to help several OEM principals into retirement and change some of the philosophy, the OMD and the governor's office was not able to change that culture fast enough to make the Oregon Homeland Security Council the policy tool it should have been. Since then, as you know, resources have become even harder. They've been continuously cut, and whatever we could have done is now largely subject to interpretation. You may remember in 2008, 2009, we were talking about having Oregon emergency management personnel throughout the regions to help support in grant development and in program facilitation. We had plans to do that, but of course, the budget's gotten in the way. My point is this: we cannot reinvent the past, we can't ignore the present. However, we can work now to build a better future. OEM has good people, a renewed focus upon proactive thinking, and the willingness to make the Oregon Homeland Security Council better and stronger. Senate Bill 1561 is important. It helped make this a priority, and I believe it has reignited the conversations we need to have, and for that I'm grateful. However, we live in a new, somewhat hopeful time. As you notice, that was handed out, FEMA has undergone some significant changes, at least in Washington, D.C., as far as its funding goes. It's now pushing things like private-public partnerships more than ever. On top of that, we here in Oregon know now more than we knew a few years back. And we also now have the aid of a model, the Be Ready Utah program, that's in the letter that I submitted, that showcases how you can actually have a policy board, a policy group that is functioning in lines of FEMA funding streams, as well as bringing the nonprofit, the private, and the public sectors together for good policy. I'm here asking you to table Senate Bill 151, or at least the parts that have to do with the reorganization of it, until next legislative session. I'm here asking you to form a work group, including all the participants. I'm here asking for you to demand an emergency preparedness capability necessary to save lives and property, and I am here asking for you to give us a chance to fix this. Let me put this into perspective. It's February. In March, it'll be a year since the tsunami devastated Japan. This isn't an esoteric exercise. This really does matter. And if we're in the new era of having to stretch resources farther and better and stronger in more complex relationships, we need to send a signal to folks that we're serious. And that means having it in statute. So here's the conclusion. I really don't believe that we can go back to what didn't work in 2005 and call it a success. The draft white paper you have in front of you is just that. It's a draft white paper, a place to start. I believe that if given the opportunity over the interim, we can actually put together an emergency preparedness board, including a Homeland Security function, that will provide you, the key decision makers in this state, with the information and the connections and the relationship to make sure we're safer before an event, that we respond better during an event, and then recover quicker after the event. We know we can do this. We have identified some of the lessons learned. We have identified some of the resources. And as a citizen, again, who isn't in this process, but would like to continue to help at least remind folks of the lessons we learned in the not-so-distant past, I know that Oregon deserves the best we can put forward. And I honestly believe that the Be Ready Utah model will save lives in Oregon if we have a chance to use it as a template for building a policy body here in Oregon. So I will conclude with that remark. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come here. Again, the points that Senator Boquist put forward, the connection to making sure that the government can operate in contingencies, those are fine. But I am very concerned the message it will send by reinventing the 2005 committee with state-only people, public state-only people, and making it a little harder, I think, to move forward. Thank you.
Any questions?
Council. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, thank you very much. And I commend you for your very frank suggestions to us. And I recognize that for many people it might be very difficult to make those kinds of suggestions or recommendations, but I appreciate your courage in doing that, and I appreciate your very blunt and straightforward analysis here. You've asked us to table this bill, and it would be helpful for me to know or to have a better feel for what direction you're going in. I'm looking for a little closer ground analysis here. What would be perhaps the top three, four, five, half a dozen things that you might recommend that we be considering as we would be entertaining a major overhaul such as you're suggesting?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Esquivel, members of the committee, I want to make sure I not overstep my bounds. I'm a citizen. I have opinions.
Understand.
Cameron and the general in the back are actually the folks that can talk to this with the current administration. That said, the things I think we all agree upon are that, number one, Homeland Security is a function of a larger enterprise, the emergency preparedness enterprise. Number two, if you're going to organize a structure like this, looking at the model of Be Ready Utah, that it makes sense to fold successes there as well as the way in which FEMA is organized. What does that mean? It means that on the white paper that's before you, I would recommend a standing Homeland Security Council of X amount of people to be negotiated that are not all public employees. I would also recognize five standing committees of the Homeland Security Council. Those five, four of which are drawn straight out of FEMA language: mitigation, preparedness, response and recovery. And then the fifth one, private public, or actually in reality non-profit private public, which they call the whole community concept now, which is the basis for the Be Ready Utah model. The third thing is I would empower a staff, and when I say a staff, it wouldn't be the full-time job of somebody to staff this, but potentially part-time, part of a job associated with staffing this. Part of the reason it failed the last time was that we threw it as one more additional duty on Ken Murphy's head. And having the director staff an organization like this, I think really does not. You need someone that can actually staff it. He was a principal and a staff. That didn't work terribly well. The next part, that we have the investment of the private sector. That's why I would actually have in the statute spots dedicated for private sector representatives, because the best plan over time would be at least partly funded by private sector dollars. The way that Be Ready Utah worked is that they organized the private sector along the emergency support functions just like FEMA, so that the private and public folks, during an emergency, it wasn't the first time they'd met. They actually had been working together on specific projects. So those key components, I think, are essential. In terms of a mechanism, if I were to recommend anything, I would recommend the contingency change in the immediate future on this bill, with an understanding and empowering a work group to report back by January of 2013 with a core structure that we can fill in and a staffing structure to make sure that it supports the long-term objectives. Because at the end of the day, what you really want is you want a policy body that covers the full spectrum of concerns and actually can come up with solutions to recognize problems and potentially even fund some of those solutions before it ever gets to the legislature. I mean, that A true working policy body could provide this legislature with, it's not a panacea, but it would provide them with more flexibility instead of always having to use state dollars or federal dollars for certain kinds of tasks. Because ultimately, if we do it right, if we use mitigation and we actually drive down the potential risk in an area, there should be some impact on insurance rates. There should be some impact on other types of activities if you do it right and if you do it in a way that everybody recognizes is the standard. That's really been the success of business Be Ready Utah. They have the Chamber of Commerce. They have the banks involved. Now, truth in advertising, there is clearly a cultural asterisk in Utah that kind of drives a lot of those policies, but I don't think that is the reason that it works as well as it does. And in fact, Renee Murphy, no relation, Renee Murphy at FEMA, who started that program, she's now at FEMA trying to help states do this. She's offered to come out and help us build it brick for brick. So those would be my recommendations.
Paul, you've mentioned in part some of the things that you would recommend a standing council that included private sector folks and perhaps some standing committees, those sorts of things. In your analysis, what are some of the things that the Utah model has done that lead to a higher rate of success?
Co-chair Witt, members of the committee, I'll hit on three things. Number one, the largest problem recognized through Utah in terms of a natural disaster isn't a flood. It's actually seismic activity. For good or for ill, and I would suggest not good, two of the major refineries in the West are literally on a seismic, what's the best word to put it? Fault, I think is the best term. It's slightly under. So when the big one happens, it's not a question of if they'll release their toxins everywhere. It's how far, whether it's going to be California or whether it's going to end up in Hawaii. So what they were able to do in terms of actual outcomes, number one, they were able to pass $100 million a bond, and this is something that is still amazing to me, on the prospective chance of a seismic event to upgrade their state capital and put it on a new system of shock absorbers. They haven't had a major earthquake there like we have had here to kind of point and do things.
Yeah.
They mobilized the private community, they mobilized the nonprofit, they mobilized the citizens, and they actually asked the legislature to put that on the ballot to fix it. Another thing that they've done, their Citizen Corps, which really Neighborhood Watch and some of the organizations that you may remember growing up and kind of being around, they were all welded together after the Department of Homeland Security was created. Those programs now are using the same language and the same tools as everybody throughout the state. Interoperability is not an issue in Utah. Now, again, without hitting a particular point too hard, interoperability has been an issue in Oregon. Here you actually have the private sector as partners driving that throughout the state of Utah. Third thing, they have partnership programs where in Utah, as you might expect, Salt Lake City is the major metro area. In fact, the Chamber of Salt Lake is really kind of the chamber of the state. But they've gone down to towns and cities of 100 or so, and actually they are integrated into their network for response. So when the big one happens, they know if something happens in this particular part of the state, these towns will come in and help with this particular type of service or this particular type of good. It is, in my mind, the most organized, orchestrated state ready for disaster. Didn't happen overnight. But over the last 5 to 6 years, they've made significant inroads. Another thing that they've been able to do, training for emergency responses. In Oregon, we were pretty excited about the fact that we have the shockers, the automatic defibrillators, right? We all pray that the person grabbing it understands how to use it if that happens. In Utah, they actually have, for teachers and for other all public employees, they have particular classes that are focused on specific elements along their training year plan. I mean, it is an integrated approach. And they didn't do this with a staff of 700. Right? It doesn't take a lot once the private sector is actually involved and they see it as a benefit. In fact, one of the major banks down there, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's the largest bank in Utah, forces their employers or their employees to go through emergency management training so that once a disaster happens and their family is taken care of, then they can actually become responders. I mean, it is the right step. It is the right way to go.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to say, I noticed that just shortly after Representative Matthews walked in, a fire truck went by with the lights on. I think he got a ride to work today.
I could have used him on the freeway earlier.
I heard. So, thank you, Paul. Appreciate your presentation. I just wanted to let you know, if you didn't, in another committee in this body, we passed House Resolution 3, which calls for the state to do a resilience plan. And it's in effect right now. I had to look in my calendar to see when it was, but it was January 26th. They had the initial get all the troops together for this planning effort. And Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council's kind of been tasked with heading this up. So it's in progress. Can't use the new chair. He's running that part of it. Well, I went to that planning meeting, and I was amazed. There were over 100 people there. It was held in the boardroom at the Port of Portland, and they literally had standing room only. So these are all people from around the state, Portland, everywhere, all the different county people. And I saw a lot of people, heard names I'd heard of but never met in person. And in a lot of cases, they are presently working like this with each other. But this meeting brought people together, and they predetermined work groups. You know, you go to a conference and you say, oh, I'm going to do this one, and this one. Well, you didn't have a chance. I couldn't sit with who I planned to sit with. And I was put in the tsunami part because I was from the coast. And so each of those little groups then, within their own partial sector of the sector, work together to find out, to make sure that they're on the same page and start working a plan from that point. And I don't know about Be Ready Utah, and I plan to look that up and see more about that, because it's always helpful to learn from other states and other entities that are doing it. So I think that there is at least something started. I know that's not the task force you're talking about here in this bill, but I think it's starting to happen more. I mean, we know what's going on pretty much, and Brigadier General back there knows this is old stuff to him. But a lot of the people now, and I mean, I hear about it from people in my district and just around the building say, oh, you know, I heard about this meeting. I tried to go, and I couldn't get in. It was registration was capped at 75, and then 25 more people came in at the door, and they didn't turn anybody away eventually. What happened is some people had to share their lunch, but, you know, it was a really big deal, so it is happening.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Esquivel, if I could just respond to that real quick.
Yeah.
It is happening around the state, and the thing that would be the goal is that a policy committee could, you're never going to get the 100% solution. But shoot for an 80% solution. And at the end of the day, recognize the groups that are functioning and sometimes the groups that aren't, and move resources to those that are working. I'll give one more example of the Be Ready Utah program. Number one, they put the lieutenant governor in charge of it. The reason they did that is it's a high enough profile to bring the private sector actually to the table. In this case, it'd be the Secretary of State, because we don't have a lieutenant governor. Number two, they recognize in Utah, not a surprise, that the church is very powerful. So they actually assigned the church certain kinds of functions. They knew they were going to be involved anyway, so they might as well be doing the things they wanted to do. In Oregon, it may not be the faith community. It may not be. It may be the Red Cross, or it may be Citizen Corps, or it may be the local emergency planning authorities that are around, or whatever it is. But a policy council can basically recommend to the legislature potential changes in policy or areas of good and bad, but also work amongst their own groups that they're representing to do just what you're talking about, to make sure that information is shared, but that it's the same information, same page. So we're not doing that.
Right.
Because ultimately, at the end of the day, we don't have time, in my opinion, to put forward energy if it's not on time, on target. I know that it's old hat and people don't want to talk about it all the time, but we're sitting at 300 plus years after the last tsunami, and we're sitting on borrowed time, and I don't want to have to look people in the eyes and say, well, we could have helped, but we didn't. And I know you have other priorities, and I know you have to weigh those things, but to me, this is a small price for a very large potential outcome. Thank you.
Just a follow-up, just to let you know, and on a very small level, that's also happening because one of the school districts in my district, the Seaside School District, has made it a priority to move all of their schools, except for Cannon Beach Elementary, which we're going to build a new local one up on the hill, hopefully. And they have decided on a spot on the east, upper east of Seaside, high enough into the out of the inundation zone, but close enough to city, you know. But the problem being there is a land use issue, and so until they because this particular piece of property that they would like to put it on, they the timber company sold. I'll be brief. They sold all their land, but to a different company. But they held out 1,000 acres for the school district, which only needed 50 acres for that piece. And anywhere in that 1,000 acres, they could take their 50, and the place they want to do it, it happens to be outside the boundary. So I guess in order to change that boundary, it takes an act of God, you know, plus Congress. And so anyway, that's been the issue, but they are definitely moving, and that's why they're doing it, because they realize that those three of their schools are, or four of their schools are in the inundation zone. And then in the rest of my district, up and down the coast, there are 7 schools that need to be moved or, you know, bad things will happen. And 4 of them are in my district. So it's really imperative, and they are. It's a very small local community effort, but it's starting to gain its steam. So things are moving as fast as we can at this point. We still need to change that land use issue to make that happen. So there's hope.
Representative Boone, instead of trying to incorporate that into the city, it sounds like you're trying to move the urban growth boundary.
Yeah.
I would just go ahead and do a conditional use permit in the county.
Well, and I know they've tried all those things, the usual stuff they've tried, and for some reason they aren't happening. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So I've got a representative partner here wants to fix it.
I'm going
to
help you fix that. Well, so, you know, I appreciate when you come because you're an evangelist. I would put you into that category. People who are bringing and carrying forward a message. And we all have those in our community. And regardless of what happens to this, I mean, I would like to see us develop something that finds those people in our community who are, you know, citizens who are, they're not necessarily state workers. You're right. They're not necessarily state workers. They are somebody who has a passion for this. I got a guy who's trying to map West Lynn. And he's trying to organize neighborhoods so that neighborhoods can understand who is sitting on what kind of resources in an emergency, whether that is you have a garden, whether it's you've got a rain capture system, you know, for water, whether you have a swimming pool in your backyard. And he's trying to map our whole city and trying to get neighbors involved to map the city for emergency management purposes, because we're on hills and grades, and, you know, we're surrounded by three, you know, two or three rivers around, you know, around the bridges, if the bridges go out, and our EMS building, I mean, we're building a new police building there because the other one's almost 100 years old and it's not seismic, and so, you know, we some of those folks who just passed the police bond are interested in this too. I think we all have people who are, you know, kind of tinfoil hat, the sky might fall, in our community who are evangelists who care about this. And somehow I think we have to find ways to tap into those people. You know, and then also as we bring forward other bills, I mean, I'm sitting here and we've listened to some of this before, but, and I think about that 211 that the state funds, and their backup for phone calls is in, like, Indiana or something. So, you know, if our systems go down, who are we partnered with where there's backup outside of our state? And that came through Human Services. You know, I sit on that committee and we're funding that. But, boy, there should be a little side note on there that for, you know, kind of crisis stuff, that something we're already funding and doing should be the backup for this type of information. And sometimes I think we don't cross committees real well when there are, you know, when bills are coming across from somewhere else, that we look to the potential for dollars we're already paying and find other ways to leverage those dollars. So I don't know what we're going to do with this bill or move it to not or not, but I'd like to find ways to pull in people like the guy in my community who's trying to map the entire city for resources in an emergency. We all have people like that in our communities who should be at the table having a voice in some of this, just because they're naturally passionate about it.
Well, I'm very fortunate, and I think most communities are, but I have a shortwave group that practice every year.
Oh, that's what it is, neighbor to neighbor.
And they drive around and do shortwave communication with the rest of the state and the nation, and we're very fortunate to have that club in our community. And they're very efficient. They're very efficient. So they'll go in and they'll set up a temporary headquarters, and they'll have all their communications there and all their short waves and everything, and they're talking with everyone all over the United States.
Neighbor to neighbor. Deb just handed me that. That's what he's trying to do in our community.
Yes, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the committee and to the folks, I apologize for my delay. An hour and 15 commute can go to an hour and a half in a matter of a traffic jam. But I'm reading this bill, and I have so much respect for what you do and what you've done. And I'm just kind of curious, when I read the bill, you're talking about public-private sector. In law, our current existing law, we had the ability for governors to, for the governor to appoint to the private sector. And that's being omitted now. Whose idea is that to take that? And where'd that come from? And if I missed it, I apologize, but I'm just curious, because what you're talking about, the private-public partnership, was existing law. And when I read the bill now, lines 26 down, it shows that that's no longer, that would be omitted. So,
Coacher Esquivel, Coacher Witt, Representative Matthews, I really don't know who poo-pooed that out. I would venture that maybe legislative council didn't understand what was going on with that language. I don't believe that Senator Boquist is not wanting private sector nonprofit involved. However, I do disagree in terms of philosophy that the clause that says the governor can appoint additional is not sufficient for the message. If the message is, we are a whole community, we have this emergency preparedness enterprise that we all have an investment in, private, nonprofit, public, then you don't invite people with a closed invitation. And I think going back to the language of 2005 sends, in my mind, a very dramatic message, because the folks behind me have been working on building relationships. It's not in statute. It's not even in executive order. But the relationships are building. And there's a very involved private sector group in Portland pushing for more private sector, private-public liaison work. There are nonprofits that are ramping up to try to take the place of things that haven't worked in the past. There are lots of little movements, and some so not so little movements, that I think when this bill comes out and it's passed and says, well, there's a new Homeland Security Council, it will be kind of one of those situations where there's just lots of explaining to do. And I don't think it's something we have to do to ourselves. I mean, that's the thing. I know that sometimes I push for formality in terms of statutes and executive orders more than maybe people should, but I think that if it's a formal part and people are a part of the government, a representative on a board or commission that's appointed by the governor, and they get that little piece of paper in the mail that says they're on this board, they take it more serious. And I think that it sends a message. It also sends a message to the privates and the nonprofits and the publics that local government, we had county commissioner involved, we had a mayor involved. It's essential, because just as the feds are expecting the state to do more, the state is expecting the counties and the cities to do more. And this new Homeland Security Council makes no room for local government. And the fact of the matter is, emergencies are local events. The incident commander is going to be at the local level. So not having some of that involvement, and again, part of it goes back to a definitional issue. And this is just a philosophical thing with me, but Homeland Security, when it came out in 2003, 2004, because of our experience with 9/11, was largely about bad guys and making sure bad guys can't kill people. Well, 3,000 people plus died in 9/11. Tens of thousands of people die every year because of tornadoes and floods and tsunamis. Dead is dead. It's all bad. If we can do something to prevent a death for whatever reason, it has to be all-inclusive. And Homeland Security is safe streets, it's clean water. Homeland Security is schools that people feel comfortable sending their kids to. It's businesses where people don't take a gun and start killing their coworkers. It's all those things. Now, if we need to do a name change, fine, and make Homeland Security, because of traditional law enforcement perspective, a smaller part of this, okay. But don't lose sight of the larger perspective.
that larger emergency preparedness enterprise is critical. And I thank you for raising that point, Representative Matthews. It is, we don't want to send the message to our private partners that they're not important. We don't want to send a message to our nonprofit partners that they're not important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comment back to that would be agreed. When I read the language as it was, we still put private sector as the last element of consideration if deemed necessary. And to me, in my world, emergency management, you know, it could be any call on any given day. We have Boeing. We have ON Semiconductor. We have Precision Cast Parts. We're responsible for hazmat up and down the gorge. And we rely heavily on public-private partnerships. We even have our own ops channel for Boeing to communicate with their personnel because that's the partnership that we have. And we thrive on that. And the community survives on that. And so I hear what you're saying. I'm a little bit torn with the fact I've got friends that are on opposite sides of an issue, but I'm okay with that. I'd like to get it right. So appreciate what you're saying today. Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair. Paul, sorry I was late. If you went over this, just say asked, answered, and we can talk later. And you may have actually answered this last year when we met, but a number of years ago, every county in Oregon was directed to come up with an emergency plan. It had to be approved by the state, and I can't remember if it was a product out of the Homeland Security stuff or what that was. But every county had to go through that exercise and present their plan to the state. As a part of that, the county I focused on most was Wasco County. Although because the size of my radio signal, I was involved in multiple counties on both sides of the river. But, you know, we were the head emergency alert station also, mm-hmm. which brings in the private sector aspect of information and emergency management. Do you know if those county plans are still active? Are they kept up to date? Was that just an exercise that we all went through and they're on a shelf somewhere? Could that play a vital role in the basis for what you're looking at here?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Esquivel, Representative Huffman, thank you for the question. General Caldwell and Deputy Director Stuckey can answer this, but what I believe that is a part of. FEMA requires an emergency plan to be in place before people can get certain types of reimbursements. So the state was trying to lead the effort to make sure the counties got them in, so if there was a disaster, they wouldn't be cheated out of some of the proportional reimbursement capture. So I believe that every county still has to have a plan. In fact, I'm pretty certain every county does have something on paper that they call a plan. I think it's up to every county's economic circumstances as to how well that plan is dressed out and how often it's practiced. One of the things that we had hoped to do, Representative Huffman, again, when we had a structure that we put forward with a little bit of a plus up in the emergency management backbone, was to have regional OEM folks that could help counties develop and exercise those plans, and also an exercise shop that would work in tandem with the military department, DAS, ODOT, and the other agencies that are required to have annual or semi-annual exercises, and basically help the counties be able to play, because a lot of counties just, they're lucky to be able to afford an emergency manager. But those plans are critical. I think that more importantly, having people come around to develop a plan is actually sometimes more important than the plan itself, because every guy that's been in a fire or been in war will tell you that no plan survives initial contact. But it's the large muscle movements and the thinking behind those plans that is critical to make sure that the relationships are there, the capacities are understood. And Representative Huffman, one of the things that I think was Governor Klingoski's shining moment, one of his shining moments was when, after top off four, most governors would have said, all right, we survived it, let's move forward, and it's not that big a deal. He actually directed the agencies to continue working on coming up with basically an inventory of assets so that we knew firsthand things like the Department of Fish and Wildlife have fish liberation trucks that could be used as water trucks if cleaned in a certain way. So that we found out that the Department of Corrections is one of the most stocked agencies with its own kitchens and its own labor supply. That ODOT has enormous capacity to be able to do things, not just in Oregon, but to call from other states. So I think the planning process is absolutely critical to what we would do, and I would envision a Homeland Security Council, or again, an emergency preparedness enterprise that looked and said, all right, for the first year, we're going to focus on making sure emergency plans in the counties aren't just plans, but give us counties, no kidding, what you need to make it functional. And again, not promising state dollars, but what do you need? So then the privates and nonprofits and the publics can all sit down and say, well, you know, I can't afford all of it, but I have a couple of generators I don't need anymore, or I have something else. Or maybe American Red Cross says, well, you know, we're looking for a new place in that region. Maybe we could work together. I'll give you one example, sir. John Buchanan, fire chief of Siuslaw Fire and Rescue. He was looking for basically a place to put some of his supplies because his fire district is getting a little bit bigger in terms of responsibilities. But he couldn't afford to build a whole new building himself because it's a small rural area. National Guard was looking to put a place along the coast with a cache of equipment. With a little bit of private investment, arguably, we could have made that deal work with all three having that. The American Red Cross was interested, but they had a leadership change, so we weren't quite able to make that work. But those types of relationships, those types of partnerships come from having plans that are known about and plans that are active. And it takes a little bit of guidance, a little bit of maybe the evangelism is the right word, a little bit of the evangelism from the state to help the locals not tell them what to do, but unleash what they need so we can find solutions. Thank you for that question, sir.
Representative Parrish.
I guess the other thing I don't see in here, and having been like the queen of the lunch ladies once upon a time in our schools, is, you know, I don't know how we wrap school districts into this conversation as well, because, I mean, I used to keep pallets of bottled water, and we had big cans of commodity foods, and I think somewhere, you know, how do you map what the resources all of these schools have that are, you know, in an emergency, quite frankly, they're tax dollars in one way or the other. How do we get local jurisdictions to, or local education authorities to immediately convert those resources over into disaster resources, and how do we know what they have? Because, you know, as individuals, we just kept our inventory. You know, it was I was the only person who had purview to the inventory and what was where, and how does that work? And then you also have like big. I mean, our school districts have big, heavy equipment that they own. You know, backhoes and track hoes and, you know, digger things and, you know, I mean, whatever they are, right? So,
digger things?
Whatever. I didn't play with those toys growing up.
Co-chair Eskwell.
Big tools and forklifts and
stuff. Co-chair Eskwell, Co-chair Witt, Representative Parrish, thank you for that point. Again, I know what I'm going to say now is not going to be supported by some of the folks in the room for a lot of reasons. One of the first issues that emergency preparedness enterprise Homeland Security Group should be talking about is, in fact, the right now difference in the emergency plans of the schools and the rest of the world. And here's what I mean by that. I was actually a part of something that the current superintendent of public instruction put forth a while back, and the core of what they were doing was using the schools as locations for facilities, morgues, things like that. Problem is, in every research document, every after-action report, every other perspective that I'm aware of would say, don't do that to the schools, because the first thing you need in getting society back up and running after an event is schools, because they operate not only as 8 to 2, 8 to 3 schools, but they also are in some cases a child care opportunity while you get the rest of society back up and running after an event. So what we tried to do, and I know that Representative Reed had a bill in about it, and Representative Clem had a bill in about it, and the military department was interested in it, we'll say, all right, instead of schools, now again, schools could be very supportive for the responders, because you're not going to destroy it with disease and other things like that for the responders. The casualties you want to kind of keep out of there. What you can use, though, is you can use county parks and state parks. County and county fairgrounds. And county fairgrounds was an interesting approach, because usually most county fairgrounds around the state that are still functioning have huge capital needs. Their buildings are going into disrepair, but they're not used a whole lot of the time. So through, again, a policy discussion and coming out with the right answers, there may be partnerships where we could outfit some of these fairgrounds around the state in areas where there is a large school capability, so we could have responders fed, showered, taken care of in one spot close by. At a county fairground, we could have potential casualties and or refugees. And you can actually figure out around the state, I like to call them like 10 floating aircraft carriers around that are tied into a specific guard armory that also has added capability. We can do this. I mean, we don't have to invent everything. We don't have to spend billions of dollars. There are a number of resources out there that can make work. And my concern about the education emergency is I was a school board member of 13J when we had this most recent flu epidemic, and my superintendent closed down the school for a week. Threw our entire community into a spiral when I'm not sure that was warranted, but that was the plan. And I think we have to have a much more integrated conversation where folks that are clearly concerned about the kids, and that's what they should do, are also talking to the business, also talking to the leaders and talking about what's the best strategy, what are phased ways to do this, what are potential areas that we can share so that you don't shut an entire community down based on fear.
Well, I'll just follow up. You know, at any given time, I had $150,000 worth of inventory in the school district. So when you think about, you know, the need to be able to quickly prepare food or, you know, put people, I mean, those are places that we're not talking about in this. And frankly, I don't think our local school district at the time that I was there wanted to be engaged in those conversations because, you know, this is our resource. This is, you know, we don't want to share this with the neighbors, you know, and yet you've got, you know, a neighboring school district that may have issues or challenges that, and how do we kind of break those imaginary lines for this type of situation? So that's something I...
Co-Chair Eskimo, Co-Chair Witt, just a last point on that. Representative Parrish, exactly your point. One of the things that this policy board could do, because, again, all these discussions are happening, but they're not always in an organized format that could be provided to the legislature like I think these proposals could be. If it's pre-designated, FEMA will reimburse at a different rate than if it's not pre-designated. So, for example, the governor's authority during times of disaster sounds kind of large, and it is. Theoretically, the governor could seize... a Walmart, they could seize a pharmacy. And that would not be a scary worst case scenario if the privates had earlier conversations to make sure what reimbursement rate would be involved. So that uncertainty and that concern about sharing would be taken off the table because they know that they'll be refit. Those things can happen.
Any other discussion? Co-Chair Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul, in the absence of SB 1561, what would be the pathway to achieving the type of outcome that you envision? Would it be an interim committee?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Esquivel, there's two options, I think. One is, again, the language for the contingency operations is a separate issue, which I think everybody agrees needs to happen. I think either a legislative work group that is chaired by this committee, because you've recognized this and are asking for it, that could have other participants, or potentially the legislature could ask the governor through executive order to stand up a task force with a due date out. So it actually has the force so agencies can spend a little bit of money in terms of having their people go to meetings and not get in trouble for that, because I know that's kind of a big issue right now. But some formal way. I think that a legislative work group, again, with this, with time limits, constraints, it is going to get done by a certain time. We are going to come out with a solution by the whatever timing you need to have bills drafted for the 2013 session would be a good plan. And again, you know, obviously I'll do whatever I can, or if me not being involved would be helpful, I'll do that too. But I know this is one of those issues that I don't think we have time not to do.
Thank you.
I think that we need to have something in place at the time, you know, like this bill. But I think, you know, we no longer have the ability to even do an addendum because of posting rules. As for the committee, the interim committee, I think you'll have a fiscal on that, so I would assume that we probably have our pretty much, we're loggerheads on that as well, because if it costs money, we have to go back through the ways and means process, and I think we're out of time. So I wish we had heard this.
But we could do a work group.
We can do a work group. Loosely net work group, but I don't think we can have an interim committee is what I'm saying.
Yes, Coach Esquivel, Coach Witt, and maybe I'm not using the right language. When we did the Veteran Services Task Force, for example, we never had any money set aside. We just kind of told people, if you want to be involved, you're going to have to pay your own way. And these kinds of conversations, I know for a fact the folks that would want to be involved, they're not going to try to claim mileage. They just want to make sure they're part of the conversation.
Because I'm not adverse to doing a work group at all, because I think what you're telling me makes sense. It just makes sense. I mean, but I wish we'd have had a little bit more time on it. So, because then we would have had an interim committee. That's what I would have rather have had.
I'm sorry I wasn't able to do more on that. I just know that when this bill was introduced by committee in January to the process, I tried to make some of the comments that I made today, and they weren't necessarily in order or of interest at that time. And it's not because of Senator Boquist's unwillingness to have these issues involved. I think he was more pushed on the timing of, as you just mentioned, trying to get that linkage to the other bill that's going to be on the ballot. My point is, since the issue is now raised, and since you are aware of it, and since it sounds like there's consensus that at least a conversation is worth it, set the work group, invite Senator Boquist and others, and the public and the private and the non-profits. There are a number of interests that want to be involved in this discussion, because we all have an interest in making sure the structure is good. Once you have structure, then you can start filling the skeleton and you can build in the programs and the policies. And I'm going to stop there and say however I can help, I'll help.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, do you see any reason why this group couldn't be formed with the governor as the chair and the adjutant general as the vice chair, whatever, in its structure representing the state, if you will, and participate in the House Resolution 3 process that's already going on as the state's arm of that?
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Boone, I'm never going to be the guy that says the governor shouldn't be involved. I would be concerned only in that if you're going to have a chair that's a public entity, then I would try to pick a private co-chair, or potentially have OEM as the chair and representatives from the governor's office. I mean, and privates in the counties. I think having the governor involved would be helpful. I think the tag should clearly be center stage. But I also want to make sure that the privates and nonprofits understand it's more than just a state-centric issue. And again, how you do that, I don't know. I think it's a messaging. If it's your work group, legislative work group, then I think all the answers are kind of, no one's concerned about that. Mm-hmm. But I do know of some folks that may not participate as openly if the governor's sitting in the room, just because of the nature of things.
We'll follow up. Well, what I'm seeing in this group that OSPAC is basically leading the effort on, there are all kinds of entities from all sectors that all have a dog in this fight.
Sure.
And so a person who perhaps didn't want to be involved with the governor for whatever reason, what I was seeing is that this group, in addition to what else it's going to do, could be a part of that planning process rather than reinventing the wheel and starting a state process here while the bigger issue is happening over here. And all the people involved are looking for somewhere to be a central point of leadership. And I think that's what the planning effort is, and that's what OSPAC has undertaken. And at the end of the day, or the year, so to speak, they will be reporting to this body, the legislature, with their recommendations. So it's not like an all-inclusive plan that's going to be finished. It's going to be a work in progress. So it'll be just part of it. And then I'm envisioning, once that gets to that point, when they're working hard, they're moving quickly on this because it's time is short. But once they get to that kind of bare bones point, they're going to see, oh, we need to do this, or oh, we should do that, and we should include. And I think it's going to move like that. So,
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, if the governor and the tag, if you, I think that it would certainly bring attention to the issue, and I think that that would be great. The only caveat I would put on any of it, and you have already mentioned it, is that there's a timeline and a deadline, so that there has to be a product out, and that folks understand that when they go in. But I, whatever you can do would be helpful.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments?
I'm going to recess for a short period of time, so I'm going to pull us out of the subcommittee. But we've been in the subcommittee, by the way, this whole time. I've been in the committee itself for a public work, but public session. I'm going to go ahead and close the subcommittee on this, and then I'm going to recess the committee for a short period of time.
Veterans Affairs. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1561. General Caldwell.
You just need to rest.
You're on, sir. And a Cameron Smith. You must be Cameron Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the committee, I think the testimony that you just heard for the last 45 minutes or so, I think did a wonderful job of depicting exactly what we need to do in Oregon and which we're attempting to do at this point. I don't think we need a law to tell us to do a task force. If this group wants a task force, we're working on this thing, on this very issue, all the issues that Paul talked about. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department and the Interim Director of Office of Emergency Management. Just to not repeat what was previously said, but a couple items that I'll just emphasize. One, I think that the testimony was spot on. I have no disagreements with it. Two, when we first went to Utah, Mr. Evans was part of the Homeland Security Council at that time. He went along with us. We were invited down there to look at what how Utah does do their work, and they do a marvelous job in their emergency management business. But oddly enough, we weren't invited by Utah. We were invited by Pacific Corps, who has properties down there, and they're very familiar with what goes on with respect to the planning that was done. We have had a ad hoc group with the energy sector. It includes PPNL and Northwest Natural, BPA, the energy providers in the Portland area. That's been ad hoc. It's not in statute. It's, we meet about every quarter. There's a meeting that is put together. I'll give PUC the credit for kind of putting this together to make it happen. And it was Pacific Corps that came to us and said, why don't you come down there with us? We'll make all the arrangements and we'll go down because we think you can learn something from this. And they were absolutely right. We learned a ton. It was a very fine operation. We came back with ideas how we're going to implement a similar structure here in Oregon, and it's been a slow progress. I'll be honest with you that one of the big problems that we have is simply we don't have a large staff. Idaho has a bigger staff in their emergency management operations than Oregon does, just as an example. And so we've tried to patchwork it together, keep it moving, but it hasn't had a tremendous amount of expense on our part because we just don't have it to give. Having said that, we're still continuing to march in that direction. We think it's important, and everything that Paul said is absolutely spot on with respect to what we really need to do to accomplish to make a better emergency management system here in Oregon. To the bill, I would say that we're okay with it either way. I can assure you that I think that we'll continue to move forward with this. With this idea, with the whole Be Ready Utah, with or without this bill, I think the effort, Senator Boca's effort, was to get a more manageable, less robust organization put together. And I think that's worthy of consideration as well. But in the long run, we know it's in our best interest to continue to move forward. The legislature did give us authorization for a position to do public-private partnership work. We haven't filled that position, and we didn't fill it because of the budget crisis we're in. I was pretty certain that would get swept, and that position would be gone at this particular session. So we elected to keep it open so we could prevent further layoffs of people that are already there. I didn't want to hire somebody, hire them in August or September, and lay them off in January or February. So we chose not to do that, and we waited for this. Now, with the endorsement of the legislature so far in this budget, we're going to put that job on the street here in the next week or two, and we're going to hire it. Now, that may be foolhardy. We may be back here in May and have another problem, but we're feeling a little more confident after this go-around, with assuming that what we think's in LFO comes out that way. So, but that's still to be determined, I know. So with that, I'll close my testimony and assure you that I think we're invigorated to the degree that we want to see a better system, and we will, once we hire this position, that will be part of that position's duties, is to better manage this whole enterprise, as Paul termed it, which I think is accurate. you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Just, Representative Boone?
And I maybe I missed it. What was the title of this person or this position?
Co-chairs and Representative Boone. The position is a public-private partnership individual. I don't know the exact term on the job announcement, but that's essentially what it's going to do.
Okay, thank you.
And like I said, we've done well in the energy sector. We haven't done as well in the other sectors like the Walmarts and those folks. We have relationships, but it's informal. It's not as formal as it needs to be, as Paul indicated, as goes on in Utah. And it's an amazing system they have there. And but they've been at it for about 10 years now. So...
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, policy advisor with the governor's office, and I would concur with General Caldwell. I mean, it's been excellent to hear over the last hour this much engagement on emergency management from the legislature. It's impressive, and I thank you for your interest. Paul has broad shoulders and likes to shoulder the blame of any situation we are in, but much of our success has been to his hard work and advocacy and evangelism. That we all have recognized. What I think the state of Oregon does well on emergency management is that cross-state agency coordination. OEM is that central model, supported by military, ODOT, state police, public health. We rally in a time of crisis across our state agencies and have excellent coordination. What we do reasonably well is that intergovernmental relations down to the local level in terms of our city and counties and up to FEMA, Region 10, and the feds. What we don't do as well is more that Utah model, what kind of FEMA is calling the whole community front. How do you get that cross-coordination on emergency management from all levels of government, business, big business, small business, nonprofits, faith-based, American Red Cross, and everyday citizens? And so it's been a challenge. How do we move more towards that model, knowing that for the mission that OEM has, I can't think of an agency that has more responsibility but less support in terms of resources and staffing. I think it was even called out in the last budget by LFO that so National Guard's work out in what's the Oregon Youth Challenge
right.
has a larger budget than OEM's budget, and it's not that they're a worthy mission, but there's huge responsibility put onto OEM in times of crisis. So my only hesitancy has been from a staffing perspective. I think we need to think long term. How do we build this over the next decade? Not trying to ramp something up quickly that then peters out due to a lack of resources and support. Given that we're pulling in all sectors of this economy. And the community, we don't want to engage folks quickly and then have it kind of fall flat and lose that interest. So this kind of initially grew. So the Homeland Security Council, I think one important part in my mind, to Representative Matthews' point about chopping out kind of the additional appointees. Right now, current practice for the Homeland Security Council, the governor's only appointed those that have been called out specifically in statute to be the governor, adjutant general, state police superintendent, and I think it's director of OEM, and then the legislators. It was an unwieldy, I mean, you can quickly, public-private partnership, you can include everyone under the sun pretty quickly. And it's really a vision, is the Homeland Security Council going to be that overarching public policy emergency management organization for the state? If it is, clearly we need to include all folks. If it's more of a targeted model, and in my mind, Homeland Security is more terrorism-focused, security-focused, as opposed to kind of a broader all-hazard emergency management approach, in my mind, we create an emergency management council that kind of has that broad public-private partnership. And I would have almost the Homeland Security Council, a subset of that, that is more targeted, that is more focused. Just from my experience in the governor's office, in a time of terrorism or crisis, the governor is not going to be convening a 17-person body, but it's going to be that core folks of the Attorney General, State Police Superintendent, the Adjutant General, pulling that, you know, And with this Homeland Security model, you do have that legislative component that Senator Boquist has been pushing in terms of if we really hit a true disaster, and I mean, we're not talking our fires, floods, and storms that we handle well that are more regional-based, so the other parts of the state, but it is that broader Cascadia, what is kind of a doomsday scenario, but very, you know, it's doomsday, but it's realistic. So in my mind, Homeland Security can be everything under the sun, just like economic development, just like so many of our other areas, with too broad a mission, with too broad membership, and not enough staff support. That's what made it unwieldy. So this has kind of been, current practice has narrowed it. So I'm very comfortable with leaving the authority for the governor to appoint more broadly should, over the next year of this discussion, as we build towards 2013, if we determine that the Homeland Security Council and this statute is the area that we want it to be in, we have that flexibility. So I'll leave my comments at that and take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Briefly?
Mr. Chair, I just want to put on the record that whatever form this takes, something that I don't see happen on a regular basis, and it needs to, and I know this is going to sound like a very partial statement, but broadcasters need to be, you know, the executive director, president, CEO of Oregon Association of Broadcasters needs to be a core member so that that information can be disseminated out, because you can have all the public safety going in the right direction, and unless you're communicating with constituents, they're not going to know where to go, what to do to get what they need. And I spent 22 years organizing and doing that for that Mid-Columbia area, and I know how critical it was for the broadcasters to lead the way.
We agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Cameron and General, what would you think of incorporating OSPAC's membership into that? Because they're already doing that work. It's a pretty broad representation, and if they were made part of that group, they're already working on a lot of that stuff, and they wouldn't have to be brought up to speed. But they do represent all kinds of areas from public and private.
Co-chairs and Representative Boone agreed. We're already involved in OSPAC quite with our one person. We have one person assigned to that task, and she does a marvelous job. And I think with the leveraging that's occurred through the rest of the community in there, it's making that whole subject matter much more prevalent to the communities, and I think that's positive. We have no issues with that at all, because it's hand in glove with what we're talking about.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Anyone else would like to comment on this? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1561. We'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 1561. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 1561 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Witt has moved Senate Bill 1561 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any comments?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a subsequent motion with regard to the formation of a work group, and now, as I say, I would like to make that as a separate motion after we entertain this one.
Sure. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so passed. Who would like to carry that? Bill. Representative Huffman would step forward. Okay, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill. Oh, you want to do the now?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would move that our committee create a work group that would be focused on emergency management here in the state, you and I work with General Caldwell to design an invitations list for that work group.
There's been a motion that we form a work group
Co-Chair Witt and I will work with General Caldwell in order to get the people in place, the placeholders, and the people that we need to have on this work group. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So move. I would like to say that if you, as members of this committee, would like to participate in this, we'd definitely like to have an email, if you'll email Janet on that issue, so that way it doesn't put anyone on the spot. So, are we good with that, General? Where'd he go? Okay, he's hid back there. So, okay. Okay, I'm going to open up a... close the work session on Senate Bill 1561. I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1563. Val Conley.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Val Conley, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I am here today to provide information regarding the adopted amendments to Senate Bill 1563. The bill adds community colleges to ORS 351.656, which provides a tuition waiver for dependents of service members killed while on active duty and dependents of veterans who are 100% service-connected disabled or who died as a result of their service-connected disabilities. The current statute requires the Oregon University System to offer tuition waiver but does not include the community colleges. Senate Bill 1563's adopted amendments place community colleges in statute, but with a much more limited pool of eligible recipients. Although ODVA does support this bill, we would like to note that the amendment does not address the original intent of Senate Bill 338, which required community colleges to come up with a common set of policies that aligns with the Oregon University System. In fact, this amendment creates another standard for community colleges. Specifically, Senate Bill 1563 would reduce the eligibility of the waiver at community colleges to dependents and survivors of those killed while on active duty and those who died of a 100% service-connected disability. It eliminates the survivors and dependents of those who died as a result of a service-connected disability and eliminates the dependents of those veterans who are rated 100% service-connected disabled. We understand that the intent of these limitations was purposeful as it reduces the potential financial impact that the requirement would place on the community colleges. One of the issues that ODVA is concerned about that is not addressed in this amendment, but seems to be a discussion point, is the dependent educational assistance benefit offered through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. ODVA does not support DEA being considered as a source of federal dollars where that money will be required as payment for tuition. ODVA also does not support the policy that if a student is eligible for this allowance, then they will not qualify for the tuition waiver at community colleges. As we have testified before, DEA is an allowance that is intended to help dependents and survivors while attending school. The money is not intended solely for the use of tuition payment. The allowance is paid directly to beneficiaries for many expenses, including subsistence, tuitions, books, fees, etc. Let me note that while we have some disagreement on this policy, we still consider the community colleges an important partner in supporting student veterans and their dependents. We all want to do the right thing, and Senate Bill 1563 is a step in that direction. Thank you for your time today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Boone.
Well, not so much a question as a comment. Thank you, Val, for your testimony, and I totally agree with you. And it makes it difficult for me. I will support the bill, but it makes it difficult for me because I think that we shouldn't be discriminating against any of those who should be receiving this because they're choosing community college over the rest of the OUS.
Representative Hoffa.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just just a comment, going back to our hearing the other day, and Bridget from OUS, you know, testifying that there is a marked difference between OUS and community colleges in the cost structure and the way most students attend a university versus a community college. Oftentimes, most times, they attending a community college, they have a local support system. Maybe they're staying at home for that two-year period or whatever. And so I think there are a lot of differences, and it's hard to sit in this room and say that we're comparing apples and apples, and because I don't think we are. And I believe community colleges have stepped up and are doing their best for the most. And nobody has testified that we are leaving dependents without educational opportunities. Nobody could produce a list, and so I respectfully, you know, disagree with the department's position on this. I think we're universally providing what needs to be provided to folks. That's probably not 2 cents worth. It's maybe a penny, but
yeah, it would have been different if we'd have had a list of people that we had not taken care of, but I don't see that. Did not see that in the last meeting that we couldn't produce a list with people. So,
no. Representative. Yeah, and I remember that too. I just hope we don't end up with a list. Put it that way. I don't feel that we are. I feel that the testimony we heard was the community colleges said they're individually trying to do what they can individually so far, and that's, you know, for me that's good. I just hope we don't end up with people who can't because it's a money thing and not, you know, meeting the intent of that bill. So,
well, I think general consensus on this committee is that we're using federal dollars first. I think that was the general consensus of what I spoke with everyone. Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your testimony. It is tough. I do agree that the OUS structure is different from the community colleges, and I appreciate community colleges coming forward. If we did have testimony, compelling testimony of family members saying I've been outed, that would be helpful. The biggest thing is I think we have to be careful that we don't push this thing to the limit where it's so strict there's no flexibility for our community colleges to make things work too, because currently right now we're not hearing about problems because I think they're getting handled at those 17 different levels. If we create a system so stringent that they don't allow that flexibility, we could end up with a bunch of problems. So right now, I'm kind of where the department's at. I support the bill moving forward. But also I hope I'm sitting here to be the first in line when somebody says I have a problem. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you, and I hope that people don't come forward to testify on this issue. I truly do. Thank you.
For the record, we have received written testimony from Robert Thornhill that will be entered into the record. Okay. Anyone else like to comment on this? Seeing none? Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I personally would benefit from the community colleges giving their perspective on some of the amendments here, just as a clarifying exercise.
You want to pull them in on the work session? I was going to do.
Okay, that'd be fine.
Yeah. No one wants to testify any farther for the public hearing. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1563. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1563. We have in front of us two particular amendments. Would you read the amendments and explain them, please?
Yes, Co-Chair Esquivel, members of the committee. Proposed Dash 6 amendments would delete the entire section on tuition waivers. It would remove Section 12 from the bill as it is. That would leave the bill with no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. The proposed Dash 7 amendments make a few clarifying changes. It clarifies that a service member must have been an Oregon resident at the time of death, and it clarifies that active duty is federal active duty or service at the call of the President of the United States. This retains the same fiscal impact as the original bill, and there is no revenue impact.
Thank you.
We would like to hear from the community colleges on, very briefly, on the 6th and 7th amendment we have in front of us, the Dash 6 and Dash 7.
Representative Escobar, members of the committee, my name is Krissa, Krissa Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. On the amendment, Dash 7, to clarify the residence, it takes only 3 months to establish residency in Oregon for community colleges. So anybody could move from anywhere in the United States and do that within 3 months and be eligible for free tuition. So if this were to move forward, we would want that clarified. I don't have background on why the word federal was added to federal active duty in that amendment.
Chair Esquivel, members of the committee, for the record, John Wyckoff, Legislative Director of the Oregon Community College Association. Our preference would be that the committee adopt the Dash, I believe it's the Dash 6s that remove the entire section. The reason being that the Dash 5s do is add, is create sort of a bifurcated system that I think would create more confusion than we have now, which has been something for which we have received quite a bit of criticism in the past, that we had a system that had varying standards, and the colleges have worked very hard to make sure that their eligibility standards are uniform across the board. And I think the fact that the way this program would be drafted, it singles out one entitlement program, the John D. Fry, Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry scholarship, which only goes to dependents, and is something that the spouse or dependent then has to decide whether they want to accept DEA benefits or the Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry scholarship, that it's an either or. I think it creates it muddies the waters and creates an even more confusing situation where we have one program that counts as first dollar and is singled out to do so, whether it be the Pell Grant or some other sources of funds, the financial aid office at the school can't look at the resources available except for this one program that only a part of the population we're talking about is even eligible for. So I think for us it makes the approach more confusing and takes flexibility away and then puts it into a and then applies as first dollar, kind of singles out one program narrowly. Should the committee move forward in that direction, we would ask that you adopt the Dash 7s because they do tighten up some of the drafting where it would make it so that the spouse and dependents were of folks who were Oregon residents at the time of deployment, which wasn't in the original language, and would say that they were killed in action and not just simply in military service, I believe is what they do. And so we would, if you move forward, would like to see those tightened up, but ultimately we don't think that's the right approach, that this approach is the right approach.
Any questions? Co-Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm having trouble with the Dash 7 amendments, and on a couple of different levels. I would like for us to be able to honor every service member and provide these benefits for a family, whether or not the individual who is the veteran died in Oregon as a resident or not. Now, what I would like and prefer may mean that it is a very significant financial imposition on the community college system, and if you need to temper my desire to cover a broader group, please do so.
Chair Esquivel, Chair Witt, I think the concern for the colleges is, you know, in the original language, anybody in the United States could move to Oregon for this benefit, which could create a significant fiscal burden for the colleges, and it's just hard to determine what that number would be. I mean, it's and so what the language would do is say if you were deployed from Oregon, you would be eligible, and that's the concern there. And that, I mean, I think that was the same justification for narrowing this bill, is that if in its original version, when it included all of the three categories, that's a just much larger group that could have, you know, especially on a small college. I mean, take a Blue Mountain where a lot of, I mean, you get a disproportionate number of folks who were deployed from the Pendleton area. That could be a significant burden for a college of that size, that could have a very significant fiscal.
Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
I recognize that, and I remember our discussion about that the last time. But and I know that none of us has a crystal ball that can determine how many people would be inclined to take advantage of that kind of scenario. But I personally find it difficult to believe that a lot of people would move significant distances to take advantage of that benefit. There may be those instances where we have a family that could truly benefit from additional education. The veteran died outside of Oregon state border, but they are living here in this state.
Chair Esquivel, I believe that it's not that they have to die within Oregon. I don't think that's the case. I think it's that they were deployed from Oregon. I think we would assume that they would probably have died in combat. And so that it's not actually, unless I'm misunderstanding.
No, I guess what I'm intending to say is that they were considered an Oregon resident at the time of their death.
And just quickly, I would also add, I mean, again, the approach for the colleges have been to use, to implement this program as a safety net so that everybody who wants to attend, who's a spouse or dependent of a fallen soldier or a soldier who's been left 100% disabled or died as a result of their injuries, will be able to attend school. And if that is done, will be able to attend college. And if that is done through federal dollars, then the student's able to attend, and then it's done with federal dollars. And if those dollars aren't available to the student, then the college will make sure that they're able to. So we've, you know, with very scarce resources available, we've tried to implement this program just to make sure that that nobody falls through the cracks, and that what we're essentially doing is filling the cracks.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize in advance, but I would like an answer perhaps from ODVA, perhaps from General Caldwell, of how many people we would exclude with the term federal active duty in the amendment. I'm also concerned about that as well.
Any questions of this panel?
Yes. Just briefly, I think one of the biggest concerns I still have, and it is, and we've talked about last dollar, first dollar, it keeps coming up, but I think it's a valid point to have a concern about monies that are in a program that are determined for living expenses to go into your tuition first before they go to your living expense. And I think that I'd like to hear how we make sure that doesn't happen. You know, and I use myself as the example, the VEAP program, Veterans Educational Assistance, went to Mount Hood Community College. I would get a check, I would pay tuition, but I'd have living expenses. I think there's a concern, and I think it's real, that we're going to take those checks and apply them to the entire tuition first, and then there'll be nothing remaining for living expense. And I want to make sure that we get that on the record, how we avoid that scenario.
Do we not give the check to the individual? We don't give it to the college. It's up to the individual.
Representative Matthews. Representative Escobar. It does go to the individual, and it is for subsistence. It's for tuition, fees, books, equipment, the entire package. I think a lot of the, when you look at what a student needs to go to school, you need to have the guidance counselors involved, financial aid counselors involved, because there's so many different angles at this and so many ways of looking at it. With the scholarship that's in the amendment, the Fry Scholarship, that is part of the post 9/11 GI Bill, and it is tuition fees specifically, but it also is basic housing allowance and books. So really, with these packages need to be tailored to the student, what the student needs are, so that that doesn't happen, because they don't want to leave the student with no money to live on.
And that's why I'm a fan of the flexibility. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a fan of flexibility. My issue also is, you know, we made comments earlier, and I don't want to seem callous about this. We're almost saying, well, until the problem comes before us, we're not going to do anything except what, you know, what you want to do.
The problem.
And I really want to make sure that people understand. I'm hoping the problem's not out there just because I haven't heard of it. I don't believe that it doesn't exist. I'm going to be looking into that. But I do understand we're trying to get what we can get, not necessarily what we want to get out of this.
Right. And if I may, Chair Esquivel, Representative Matthews, the program, the way we have designed it, is set up so that if a problem does arise for a student, then it is addressed. I mean, I think you're right. We don't at this point know of a lot of that there is a long list of students who haven't been able to attend. On the other hand, it's very hard to prove a negative. So I don't want to tell you that doesn't exist, because there's nobody out in the world that exists that way. However, our program is designed so that when that problem arises and you have a student who, for whatever reason, can't get benefits or the Pell Grant, that the college then steps in and says, your education is taken care of. And then just to address sort of the technical point of what you were talking about, it is right that the with the DEA benefit, it's a check that goes directly to the student. Now, the Pell Grant, for example, would be different, where the way the Pell Grant works is it goes to the financial aid office first, they deduct tuition, and then the student receives a refund check. So in that case, it would go directly, and that's just the way federal financial aid works, but the DEA is, as an entitlement, goes directly to the student.
Any other questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I'm trying not to be too confused here, but I am. But so just to clarify, John, you testified that you support the Dash 6 but not the Dash 7. Is that right?
Yes, the Dash 6 is the one that I have to. I apologize, Chair Esquivel, Representative Boone. I haven't seen the amendments in front of me, and so it is the Dash 6, right, that removes the entire language. We would support
Section
that.
12.
But again, should the committee decide to move forward with the approach that came from the Senate, we would ask for the clarifications that are in the Dash 7s. But again, we don't fundamentally support that approach, but we do believe it improves the approach.
And follow up. And I just want to make sure somebody did bring up the issue of federal. It says includes all federal active duty and reserves. Just to be clear, if, for example, someone's in, maybe this is a General Caldwell question, if someone's in the Guard and they haven't gone to Afghanistan or something, and we're getting out of these wars, but they've gone to the help with the floods and things like that, does that preclude them or not? And that's what I worry about that. Because they're still, in my view, they're still in the military.
Yeah. Chair Esquivel, Representative Boone, I think that is a Caldwell question.
General Caldwell, not Chris Caldwell.
Yeah. We're getting a quorum of Caldwells.
We've got a quorum of Caldwells.
I'll make it quick. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. Actually, I was asked about that language, I think, by the Senate staff, and I sent him an email telling him, trying to explain the differences between the different statuses that we have. For instance, all National Guardsmen are under U.S. Code Title 32, which means they're in the control of the governor until such time as they're deployed or at the call of the president, and they go on what's known as U.S. Code Title 10. All active duty soldiers are under Title 10, but so are the reserves. So the only Title 32 piece belongs to the Guard. So you can be a reservist, you can be under the same title. So if you say, well, we'll make a Title 10 versus Title 32, it doesn't really do that. You've got to have the call of the president before you're on federal active duty, even though the titles are different. So I tried to make it, I said, this is the clearest I can give you, is you're called by the president, under the presidential call for active duty, then that is a very defined term, and everybody knows what that means. So if you were a guardsman or you were a reservist under either one of those two codes, and you're out helping in a flood, a fire, whatever, and you're killed, then no, you wouldn't qualify in this status as a reservist. And the question really came up in the Senate was, they were talking about killed in action, and I think everybody on that committee thought, this is killed in action. It doesn't say that. Say that in the bill anywhere.
Right.
So if that's the intent, again, clarification, if the intent is to, honor the or give this benefit to folks that were killed by hostile forces in action, or they could get run over by a truck in Afghanistan, they're still in a combat zone, and they would also be eligible for it. So I don't know what they obviously didn't clarify it in the Senate. So I think the way it reads now, you could be standing at Fort Knox going to get a hamburger and get run over, and you're injured, and you would qualify for the benefit, which I'm not opposed to that if that's what the committee wants to do. It's just that you need the clarification, Otherwise, it's going to get really murky for everybody to interpret. And then at the end of the day, you'll have people that have been interpreted in, interpreted out, and you'll have a different application to what maybe your intent is. So that was the whole attempt at that. Does that help?
Well, if I may, my intent would be, if you're in the service, you're in the service, regardless if you're in the reserves or on active duty in Afghanistan or some other place. And if you are killed in action in Tillamook helping with the floods, say a Humvee runs over you or whatever, you fall into the creek or whatever, then I think that you should qualify for this because you are being in active duty in the Oregon Guard. And if we're going to specify Oregon residents, I think that makes sense. I don't know.
I think for clarification, a KIA to me is someone that's killed in action. Killed in action, so that means that it's in a combat zone. But I think there's many times we have a lot of our personnel, example, on a carrier, sometimes they lose 3-5 people, even though they may not be on a combat zone. It's just accidents that happen around aircraft when you have dangerous weapons and things of this nature. People get hurt, and catapults and so on and so forth. So I think it's the interpretation of they were in the service, they were on active duty. I think that's, to me, that's the clarification.
Anyway, I'd like to hear from anything else.
Well, so just to be clear, then, does that mean if we adopted the dash sevens that those people who might be killed in action but not hostile action would be precluded from this?
I don't think they'd be excluded.
They if I may.
Included.
Chair Esquivel, yes. Representative Boone, I think too that it's worth noting under our current program, though it is not a first dollar program, I think you would have a wider application of it. I don't think we would, I think we're applying it more broadly, but looking at all the resources available. And in this case, when you're applying it as first dollar, it seems to be narrowing some of it. But I think in the current program we have, we're looking at it a bit more broadly. But again, also looking at all the resources available and applying federal resources first.
Okay. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to hear. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to state that I have a problem with a member of the Oregon Guard who would be out and potentially killed in a forest fire, fighting a forest fire or whatever, and his or her family not being entitled to these benefits. I just have a major problem with that.
The problem with seven, then?
The dash seven amendments, yes.
I'd like to hear from Director Willis real briefly. Any other questions from this group? Thank you. Thank you. Sorry that we didn't get to you today, Director Willis. I'm getting the evil eye here. I can see it because we didn't get to your presentation. And well, we can I thoroughly apologize, but we can do that at a later date.
Sorry, we can do that at a later date, Co-Chair and Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee.
Looks really cool, by the way.
It is. It's very nice. Doesn't do well in water, though, we noticed. It gets water spots. But it's Oregon, it rains here.
It rains here, that's right.
Let me speak very clearly about this entire issue to this committee and to its co-chairs.
Could you identify yourself?
Yes, I'm Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I'd still like to speak very clearly on this issue to the committee. There should never be a question in the mind of these dependents when they come to a college setting in Oregon as to whether or not their tuition will be waived. Our position has always been that those tuitions should be waived, period. And then, if the college has the ability through their through their financial aid office to then qualify that child or dependent or spouse for a federal benefit, we have no objection to that at all. I mean, we've always talked about let's not leave the federal dollars on the table if they're available. That's fine. Okay. But what bothers me about what I'm hearing and have heard since 2007 is this first dollar, last dollar argument. Okay? And my position is very, very clear. These people who lost their lives in the service of this nation, and we have now 133 from Afghanistan and Iraq with our most recent casualty, these people gave their lives unconditionally. These people who have been certified as 100% service-connected disabled did that unconditionally. And I don't believe any conditions should be put on their dependents when they seek an education because of the absence of that parent or the inability of that parent to help because of their disability. Should just be clear as a bell. Now, were there a single policy statement covering all 17 community colleges, we'd be further along than we are today. They were directed by this body to align their policy with the OUS operation. You clearly know they did not do that. They were also asked to consult with us. We met with them one time. We told them what our positions were. Then they published their report without consulting with us, which they said they would do. So where we find ourselves today is, should this body put them in statute to align them with OUS, or continue as it is today and wait for the time when that dependent comes to this body or my office or some other governmental entity and says, I tried to get in, but they wouldn't let me. I tried to get in, but I couldn't qualify for that particular federal scholarship they wanted me to have. We don't even need to worry about that if we pass this bill and put them in the statute. And then we're done with it. And then the direction to be followed by those 17 community colleges is very clear. And the policy of this state and this body is in writing. Someone once said, if it's not written down, it didn't happen. And I agree with that. So I don't know how to make my position any more clear, and I thank you for your time.
What's your opinion of the Dash 6 and Dash 7 amendments, Director Willis?
I am not okay with the Dash 6, and I'm okay with the Dash 7.
You're not okay with the Dash 6, no. But you're okay with the Dash 7.
Yes, sir. And I will tell you that for further clarification, when it talks about a member in the Dash 7 sub A, when it talks about a member of the armed forces dying on federal active duty, that would include killed in action, as you have said, co-chair, but it would also include a member who was killed when the Humvee rolled over into a ditch and they all drowned. So they would be covered.
But I had someone over here.
Yeah, it was me, I think, and that was my question too, but you don't agree with that then?
I do agree with that.
The Dash 7s?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay,
absolutely.
But you don't agree with the Dash 6s?
No,
because,
I do not.
Okay, got it, thank you.
But would it cover the event? You know, Gresham, we had the terrible winter storm. We're not the only ones affected by it, but we had a lot of soldiers out there helping us out. Incredible help. Would they be covered if somebody all of a sudden, four-wheeler comes off the road, wipes one of them out while they're helping out their local community under the direction of the governor? Probably not.
Not without an amendment to sub A. And
right.
I spoke just a moment ago offline with General Caldwell about this. And if you look at that last line where it says, or while serving under the call of the President of the United States or the call of the Governor, which is the Title 32, that one addition would cover, as Representative Boone and Representative Matthews have talked about, would then cover that guardsman who was killed on a flood, on a fire, on an earthquake, any other kind of natural disaster we could think of. And we all know there's not been in the history of our state that many But my goodness, they deserve, their families deserve this kind of benefit just as much as the people killed on federal service.
Any other questions?
Just to be clear, maybe I need that second cup of coffee sooner than I thought. So if we did the bill without either amendment, would those people be covered?
The guard people you're talking about? No.
Okay.
No, ma'am. They would not. Not unless they were under Title 10, serving at the call of the president.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Appreciate it.
Members of the committee.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1563A. And I'm going to open up, I think we need to have a work session and discuss this on what people really feel about this whole situation. Representative Boone, I'm sure we all, and Representative Parrish, I'm sure we all have our own thoughts on this, and I'd like to hear just as a work session so we can talk freely about it. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1563A. I'm going to ask people, what do you think? We have two or none amendments in front of us. The one, as my understanding, if we do nothing, it won't handle the situation that we were discussing about the National Guardsmen.
And that's the dash
and then
seven.
The other one, I don't know. What's the will of this committee? I guess. Co-Chair Witt.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is from General Caldwell's testimony that the Dash 7 amendments would disqualify the dependents of an Orange Guardsman who has been killed in state-related
duties.
Okay. I think that is grossly unfair and disrespectful of our State Guard, National Guard. I cannot support that amendment under those conditions.
Yeah.
With respect to the Dash 6 amendments, and my greatest respect for Jim Willis and ODVA and all of the good folks that are over there representing our veterans. We had testimony the last time on Senate Bill 1563 that in essence from both the community colleges as well as our state military department that they were unaware of any veteran having lost access, excuse me, any dependents of veterans having lost access to community college education by using federal benefits as first dollar. And given the very severe economic climate in this state, and the cutbacks that our community college system has had to sustain in the past number of years, I think it is critically important that those federal benefits be accessed first, and I would be in support of the Dash 6 amendments.
Representative,
since we're running past, and I don't need to reiterate what I've spoken very clearly on the record three or four times, I support the Dash 6. Regarding the other issue, I have always, I'm in agreement, I think, with most everybody up here. It's if the veteran was active and active service, I don't think it has anything to do with action part of it, but if they were active duty and active in service, then they should be covered. Not out of country, not in a kill zone, nothing like that.
Just in service.
Active service.
I agree with that.
Parrish.
I agree with that too. We've had soldiers, and I'm trying to think what the exact circumstances were, if it was an AT or annual training or whatever, who've, you know, died during trainings here you know, in the state or wherever they're doing trainings. We've had those situations. I mean, I'd like to make sure that those families are covered. I guess, you know, whether it's first dollar or last dollar, I think the biggest thing for me is, I mean, I understand how those dollars get applied. You get your Pell Grant and you get some of these other dollars out there. What I don't want to see happening is people having to take out the loans for housing. If your parents truly gone, you know, these are kids then that are kind of, in some ways, almost kind of like foster kid. I mean, we just did something for foster kids in the last session. You know, those are kids now who don't have a direct tie to some of the things that other students would potentially have in terms of family who's giving them support. So I know that was a tough bill last session. But it's that same type of thing. And so I'm torn, and I also understand how constrained our community colleges are. And nobody's come to me and said that they're not getting this benefit. So I guess I'm concerned, are we doing trying to apply something that, you know, we're fixing, it's got a solution for something that nobody's come to any of us, I don't think, and said, community college isn't supporting me through the process. And we heard in another day's testimony where, you know, they would look at things like housing on an individual case-by-case basis and try to help make sure the students had their needs met.
The other?
I agree with my colleague from the River District on what he said, and I really hope that we can get to a point, I think it would help a lot if we could get to a point to make sure that we are funding our veteran service officers on these campuses. I think they've been proven to be such a really good resource for our veterans, and take it on. I didn't hear from my colleges on this one, but I definitely do not want to support something that would leave out a member of the service who was killed in action or disabled, but not in a, you know, on a local duty, but not on the other one, and just because they weren't in a war zone. So I can't support the dash sevens.
I'm conflicted on this issue, like everybody. I think I can understand where everybody's at on this. I think for me, I worry about where we are as a state and where we are as a nation for our veterans. I worry that if we don't ask for everything now, we're not going to get it later.
Sure.
You know, the compelling arguments are before us because we have troops deploying and troops coming home, and we're darn good at mobilization ceremonies in this state. And so it bothers me that we're here sitting here in February without the ability to get it right, so that if they do deploy within the state, as we have several emergencies that we call on these folks to serve, and they do a great job, I love our soldiers, we're not protecting them in that capacity, and we don't have time to do that. So we have before us a bill that, you know, and I get the community college doing everything that they can get to get there, but also we have students in the community college that call us every day about rising tuition fees. So this could be another reason to raise those tuition fees. But for me, it's probably not the popular opinion. Where I've landed today is supporting the underlying bill. If the amendments are necessary on the dash six, I can respect that, but I can't support that. I'm going to ask for everything I can ask for veterans today, because I think our arguments are going to be less compelling as we gather here next year and the year after that and the year after that. And so I applaud this committee. It's my favorite committee. Hats off to each and every one of you that serve in this committee and those members that come and testify before us. But at the end of the day, I got to tell you, I worry about where we're at as a state for these fine folks that are serving this country.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I'm going to make a statement here, and I hope that my co-chair goes along with me, that I would still like to see this community colleges get some sort of a policy that works for all 17. You've been asked that in the past. You have not done your work. You have not come forth with that. And I think this is like Groundhog Day with this type of a situation. And I don't want to see it next time. Now, if you won't take care of it, then maybe I would hope this committee would. I would implore this committee to go ahead. And if we have to do it, then we'll do it. You may not like the outcome of that. So, anyway, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash six amendments to Senate Bill 1563.
Co-Chair Witt has moved the dash six amendments to Senate Bill 1563, and that amendment is dated 2/20/2012. Any discussion? Any objection?
Seeing, I'm a no on that dash six amendment.
Roll call, please.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Matthews.
No.
Co-Vice Chair Parrish.
Yes.
Co-Chair Esquivel.
Yes.
Co-Chair Witt.
Aye.
Okay, so moved. Now I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, if you're looking for a motion on the dash seven amendments.
No, no, I'm not.
Okay.
I think it's pretty much people understand where they're at on the dash seven.
We've adapted the dash six to the bill, so we'll move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would then move Senate Bill 1563 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Witt has moved Senate Bill 1563 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1563. And then who can we get for a carrier? Who would like to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the cause?
Thank you.
And I do want to emphasize that we have Zach. Are you? Would you please stand up? This is a you're from the what is it? You're a corpsman. Is that correct? You're not a corpsman. I thought I saw a Navy uniform in your picture.
No, my brother was.
That was your brother, was it?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you come up here and introduce yourself, because your brother was, he was a corpsman.
That's correct.
Oh, and he was a KIA.
Yes, he was.
Where was he, in Afghanistan or Iraq?
Afghanistan.
For the record, would you name?
Would my you name give is Zach name? Gallinger Long.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
So, and you're the type of people we're exactly talking about today.
Yes.
So, you're on the military task force?
I am, sir.
Uh-huh. How do you like that?
It's going well so far.
So far?
Yeah. We've only had one meeting, but we've got one coming up next week.
That's usually the best way that goes, is the first meeting. So, then you start to come to grips with the problems, and it gets dicey. So, but we wanted to welcome you, and welcome you as a new member of that task force. That's the task force that we were instrumental in creating.
Very good.
That was from Stacey Bannerman, I believe, her work. So,
Mr. Chairman, I was confused at the beginning here. Zach, you're a member of the military yourself?
I am not. No. My younger brother, Riley, was, and then his twin brother, Wyatt, still is.
I see.
Is he in the Navy as well?
He is.
Oh, great people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Don't send him to the Air Force, the Marines, or the Army.
So, well, welcome, and I appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anything else for the betterment of the cause? Seeing none, adjourned.